Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, May 6, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the Department of Labor Persuader Rule. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome back to our program as moderator, Mr. Bill Emanuel. He's a shareholder at the Littler Mendelson Law Firm. There, he works with a broad range of clients, including trade associations, hospitals, and other healthcare institutions, school districts, transportation and logistics companies, and manufacturing companies. He's a member of the firm's traditional labor practice group and editor of the firm's traditional labor law blog, the Labor Relations Council. He's going to give us some background on the rule and then moderate the program from there. Mr. Emanuel, with that, please go right ahead with the program.
Thank you very much, Dean. I'm going to start off the program today by providing a brief overview of the Department of Labor's new Persuader Rule. And then I will introduce two leading experts who will explain the political motivation behind the rule and the severe impact that it will have on the attorney-client relationship if it's not prevented from going into effect. Now, more than 50 years ago, Congress enacted the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. At that time, Congress was concerned about the use of some consultants who were known as middlemen and who operated as secret management agents to infiltrate a workforce and persuade employees not to unionize. Now, as a result of that concern, the statute requires consultants to report to the Department of Labor if they persuade employees concerning the right to organize and bargain collectively, or if they provide certain union-related information to an employer. The consultant is required to do this by filing two forms. The first form after entering into an agreement to provide the services, and the second form after the end of the fiscal year. On the second form, the consultant is required to report all fees received from the employer for persuader services and related disbursements. But in addition, the consultant is also required to report on the second form all fees paid by all employer clients, quote, in connection with labor relations advice or services, regardless of the purposes of the advice or services, close quote. This language is obviously very broad, and it applies to fees paid by employers that are totally unrelated to persuader activities, and the Department of Labor construes this category very broadly. Now, in the past, this statute has not been a major problem for law firms or employers because a lawyer was not a persuader unless he or she communicated directly with employees to persuade them, either in meetings or in written communications. For obvious reasons, very few law firms have crossed the line into persuader territory by communicating directly with employees. But now, after 50 years of operating under that interpretation, the Department of Labor is changing its interpretation of the statute in order to force law firms to report as persuaders. And our speakers will have more to say about the political motivation beyond that, but that is the objective. This will be done primarily by changing the official interpretation at the Department of Labor of an exemption in the statute for providing advice. That's a key word, advice. The statute very clearly states that no consultant would be required to file a report covering services by reason of his giving or agreeing to give advice to such employer. But the Department of Labor is changing the meaning of this exemption by stating that a report is required if the consultant engages in persuasive activities regardless of whether advice is also given. In addition, and this is a second key change, the Department of Labor is vastly expanding the scope of the reporting requirement from persuasion concerning the right to organize and bargain collectively, which is the language in the statute, to persuasion concerning any protected concerted activity. And as any traditional labor lawyer can tell you, that is an extremely broad category. Now, for compliance, the department is relying on severe criminal sanctions in the statute, namely a $10,000 fine and a year in jail for a law firm's president and treasurer. The status is that the new rule has been pending at the department for almost 2 years, and it's still pending there. However, it could be issued in the very near future, although the Department of Labor is required to send the rule first to the Office of Management and Budget for approval, and our experts today will explain that process. Now, I'm going to introduce our other speakers, who are both very prominent labor law specialists, and they are two of the leading experts in the country on the new persuader rule, and they are both very, very actively engaged in the battle over this rule in Washington, D.C. The first speaker will be Michael Letito, who is an attorney and a shareholder with Littler Mendelson in San Francisco, and he's also the co-chair of Littler's Workplace Policy Institute. And then after Mike, the second speaker will be Hal Coxon, a very prominent attorney with Ogletree Deacons in Washington, D.C. And again, both of these speakers are very accomplished traditional labor lawyers with a strong interest and expertise in the persuader rule. Now, Mike Letito, would you please start off by explaining what you think all this means and what impact the persuader rule will have on law firms?
Sure. Thanks, Bill, and good day to everybody. A little bit more meat to the bone with respect to the historical context, because I think it's important. For about 2 years, from 1957 through 1959, Jack and Bobby Kennedy, through the McClellan Committee, basically took on Jimmy Hoffa and corruption in labor unions and the relationship between labor unions and employers in engaging in a variety of very questionable activities. Among other things, they determined as a result of these hearings that sometimes an employer would hire a so-called persuader middleman who typically disguised his or her real motivation and even identity and would get hired on it as an employee in a unit that was being organized and would make believe that they were one of the fellow workers. They would form anti-union committees and do a variety of other things, and at the end of each day report back to their superior as well as to the employer what was going on, who was behind it, and the like. And the McClellan hearings came out with the LMRDA, which basically said that those middlemen persuaders needed to report on these financial forms that Bill was referring to when so engaged, because this way their true identity, instead of making believe that they were Joe or Mary employee, that they were really Joe or Mary persuader hired by a persuader company, so that the employees would be in a better position to evaluate just where they were coming from. It's that basic law, and I think its intent that both Hal and I would agree with, is really being used to invade the traditional province between an attorney and its client. And I'm going to focus here just for a couple of seconds on the attorney aspects, and then Hal's going to focus in on the employer aspects of it. As Bill said, the attorneys today typically do not directly talk to employees. And because they don't talk directly to employees, the consistent interpretation over the last 50 years, Democratic, Republican administrations alike, have been that without that direct contact, there's no persuader reportable activity. Instead, the lawyer does what? They assist with respect to guidance, advice, revising materials, doing those sorts of things. And they also give guidance and advice on a wide variety of other activities, such as reviewing employee handbooks, revising solicitation distribution rules, counseling companies that are confronted with, like, the Hispanics United situation, where a grouping of employees post something on a Facebook page that's critical of the employer, wondering whether or not it's permissible to fire them. So there's a wide variety of activities that take place within this broad context. The proposed rule basically reverses the 50 years of interpretation and says that whenever an object, whatever an object is either to directly or to indirectly persuade employees with respect to Section 7 rights, which has been extended to the protected concerted activity as well as union organizational efforts, that then becomes a reportable event. On a revised LM-20 form that the law firm would have to complete within 30 days of the engagement, there's 16 or 17 boxes that have to be checked as to the nature of what the advice and counsel is going to be. This includes such things as policy reviews, engaging in training, and my all-time favorite category is the last one, which is called other. I'm always very suspicious when the government says other, especially since I have to try to figure out what other means, and if I make a mistake in figuring out what other means, I risk going to jail. That strikes me as being overbearing. But that's what the department is proposing. So this is enormous in its reach, and it goes well beyond just the attorney relationship, because there's other people that the employer may go to and seek advice where an object, either directly or indirectly, is to persuade employees with respect to their Section 7 rights. Just one illustration, let's say a company today goes to a benefit consulting firm because they're trying to figure out what to do with the implementation of ACA. They've got unionized people, they've got union-free people, and among other things, they say to the benefits consulting firm, when you come up with the overall plan as to what we're going to do, reducing hours, not reducing hours, continuing health care, paying the penalty, not paying the penalty, we want you to keep one thing in mind. And that is, among all of the other considerations, there's one more, and that is we don't want to set up a situation so that our non-union people are going to think that the unionized people have a better plan so that that's going to drive them into the union. That would make, assuming the advice was given, in my view, that would make the benefit consulting firm a persuader, because they're giving advice that has an object, either directly or indirectly, to persuade employees not to exercise their Section 7 rights. Now, we believe that this intrusion by the Department of Labor with respect to the attorney-client relationship is very, very overbroad. The American Bar Association filed comments to the proposed rule saying that the rule should be ignored, that the rule should be revoked. There's about 17 state bar associations that filed similar comments. The Association of Corporate Counsel filed comments in this regard. And they all point out that there's an inherent conflict between what the department is asking the law firm to do and what the law firm's obligations are with respect to attorney-client confidentiality under 1.6 of the ABA model codes, which deal with the requirement that the lawyer has to make sure that the employer's conversation with the lawyer maintain confidential. This is going to intrude upon that, because the lawyer is going to have to report the name of the client, the fees paid, and also, by checking these boxes, the nature of the advice that's going to be sought. And then it goes beyond that, because in the annual report, when you have to list the income received from clients that you did not provide persuader advice to, but other labor relations services, whatever the heck that means, they'll probably tell us what that means after they tell us what other means, then you're also going to have to reveal that a company that had no interest with respect to anything to do with the expansive definition of persuader, that, for example, hired a law firm in order to conduct a sex harassment investigation, that I have to report those fees from that firm and reveal the name of that company when obviously they wanted to maintain all of that as confidential. So this is enormously burdensome and it's enormously intrusive. And quite frankly, it's an outgrowth of the fact that we don't have EFCA. And Hal, I know you want to talk about the impact that this is going to have on the employers, but in my view, if we had had the Employee Free Choice Act and the quickie elections with the mandatory first contract arbitration and the like, we probably wouldn't be having this discussion, because this is just another way of attacking the employer-employee relationship on behalf of organized labor. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, Mike, this is Hal Coxon. I do. In fact, I think this proposal is really what unions have long sought. This is labor law reform, to increase union density throughout the private sector by increasing burdens on employers through government action, in this case by silencing employers without outside legal counsel. I think the revision will have a negative impact on all private sector employers, with nearly 95% of private sector employers union-free and struggling to remain so in the face of ever-expanding pro-union actions and decisions of the current NLRB, such as the quickie election rule, which will reduce the time for employers to respond to union organizing campaigns to as little as 20 days, and elections among small micro units of employees. This proposed revision to the Persuader Activity Regulation will operate to deny outside counsel for many employers. This is especially devastating for small businesses, which cannot afford to have full-time in-house legal counsel or labor relations expertise, and only call upon outside help when the employer finds the first union authorization card or else receives a petition for a union election. The typical reaction of an uncounseled small business will be anger and confusion and a desire to get to the bottom of this by interrogating employees, threatening adverse actions or consequences, promising benefits, and so on. Those are all unfair labor practices, and under the NLRB law, if those unfair labor practices are serious enough for the board to conclude that a fair election could not be held, the board has the power to issue a bargaining order, forcing the employer to recognize and bargain with the union, even without a representation election among the employees. So in effect, this would lead to backdoor EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act, where a union is certified as the employee's exclusive bargaining representative without an election. At the very least, the board has the power to reverse and reschedule an election if the union loses. The current board is doing so ever more frequently for such things as handbook statements which might be interpreted incorrectly by employees. In short, small business will be at the union's mercy if these revisions are enacted. The revisions require reporting for a whole host of typical labor relations services, as Mike indicated, such as preparing, reviewing, or editing speeches that the company official intends to deliver to the employees, written materials, supervisory training so as to counsel supervisors and managers how to communicate with employees without committing unfair labor practices, policy and handbook reviews, and so on. And the proposed revisions is damaging. Revision is damaging even for union employers and large companies with the luxury of in-house legal counsel and labor relations expertise, since it covers activities related to defending against corporate campaigns, collective bargaining and strike preparation, or other concerted activities. For example, the proposed revision requires reporting by crisis communication PR firms retained during corporate campaigns where the union attacks the corporate brand through boycotts, shareholder actions, and other tactics. While large companies have in-house legal counsel, often they retain outside counsel and PR firms for specialized advice during corporate campaigns. Also, whenever an employer seeks review of handbook policies or pension policies, such as summary plan descriptions or those mentioned by Mike and the like, or prepares a strike contingency plan, those two would all trigger a reporting requirement for the company and its outside counsel. Plus, don't forget, the proposed revisions also apply to law firms, think tanks, and others who assist members or clients with seminars and so on. And finally, the revisions
would also apply to law firms as employers. So it's extremely broad, and it's a negative effect on employers, and it really reaches the issue of federalism, I believe, through the impact on law firms. A lawyer is put in given the Hobson's choice of either not reporting a client's confidences and therefore triggering the statute and potential criminal prosecution, or reporting and triggering state bar disciplinary committee's actions for violations of Model Rule 1.6 of the American Bar Association's rules on professional responsibility for betraying client confidences, and therefore risking sanctions and discipline by state courts and potentially being disbarred. So this is a thoroughly bad proposal from the law firm's point of view, but also from employers' point of view, both large and small.
You know, just from the employer's point of view, just to add one other aspect and put an exclamation, you know, sometimes people say this is the lawyer's problem. Well, it is a lawyer's problem, but it's a business problem, as Hal just articulated from the employer's standpoint. But there's all of these other third parties. For example, trade associations oftentimes provide advice, an object of which, either directly or indirectly, might impact the willingness of employees to engage in Section 7 activity. In fact, some of the leading cases that are now 25 or 30 years old that were litigated under the LMRDA involved a trade association. Hal mentioned these third-party crisis communication firms. I mentioned the benefit consulting firms. An argument has even been made that if you go to an architectural firm to help design your office environment so that it's conducive to an employer of choice concept, one of the objects behind the employer's motivation is to make sure that the individuals don't turn to a union. Well, then I guess the architectural firm is engaged in persuader activity. So this is extremely broad.
Yeah, most employers, large and small, have positive employee relations programs in order to treat their employees fairly and well, but also, frankly, to avoid the need for a union. All of those activities that employers are involved in as part of positive employee relations could trigger a reporting requirement, because an object is, directly or indirectly, to persuade employees not to join a union or engage in collective bargaining or strikes.
Hal, can you explain the process whereby the Department of Labor has to submit the rule to the Office of Management and Budget, and how that whole thing works?
Sure, Bill. You know, this proposal was first surfaced during the Clinton administration, and the proposal dragged on so long that it became a midnight regulation. And then when George W. Bush became president, he rescinded it. And now it's back again like a bad penny. And the process is as follows. There was a notice of proposed rulemaking issued by the Department of Labor. There were about 7,000 comments filed, including comments, as Mike mentioned, from the American Bar Association. The Labor Department then stepped back and ostensibly, or theoretically, reviewed all of the comments with a view toward revising the proposal. That's been over 2 years now, and the proposal is still pending at the Department of Labor. In order for it to become a final rule, it has to be issued by the Department of Labor to the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, and it's reviewed by a group called OIRA, which is the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. They look at the proposal from a technical standpoint to make sure that all the T's have been crossed and all the I's have been dotted. For example, they would look at it to see if there has been a proper regulatory flexibility analysis, a proper economic analysis, which we maintain there has not been in this case, because the department said that this would, I think their number was about $800,000, under $1 million, and therefore would not have a substantial impact on small businesses. We've seen studies that indicate that this would cost billions and billions of dollars. So we maintain they've not done a proper economic analysis. We hope that OIRA and OMB agree with us and send it back to the Department of Labor. If that's the case, it goes back to the Department of Labor and they have to then conduct the study. But if it's approved by OIRA and OMB, it then goes to the Federal Register as a final rule with a phase-in period, an effective date, maybe 60 days, maybe 90 days, you know, it varies. And then the rule's in effect. So we're at the very end of that process right now, which is the Labor Department has done what it is going to do, and it's just waiting to send it to OMB and OIRA, who will then take action.
And Mike, is Latito, is there any sort of litigation potential if the rule goes the full distance and becomes final?
Well, there certainly is litigation potential. We think that the hearing later this week, the markup later this week by the Senate Help Committee on nominee Perez and perhaps his ultimate approval is going to be the last stop in this process before the rule gets sent over to OMB. And informed opinion suggests that sometimes in the third quarter, this rule is going to be published as final. And then with the delayed implementation, you're talking about sometime in the fourth quarter or maybe the first of the year. While we hope that that doesn't happen, we hope that that common sense prevails and that some of the comments that were filed give the Department of Labor significant pause and hopefully they just withdraw the rule. If that doesn't happen, then there certainly will be litigation. I think that these third-party consulting firms are going to find themselves all of a sudden being subjected to a Department of Labor inquiry that they've violated the LMRDA. They're going to have to defend themselves. Companies that provide video services, organizations that provide general information about unions, they're going to be subjected to these complaints. The NLRB and the Department of Labor already have a cooperative arrangement. And so today, if a petition is filed for an election, the employer will get, as a matter of course, an explanatory note telling them what their obligations of the LMRDA happen to be. You can anticipate that there's going to be more cooperation going forward. And in one published paper by a very, very excellent union side lawyer, he's talked about how to mine ALJ decisions, regional director decisions, and the like in order to find opportunities to file complaints. So all of that is going to lead to litigation of one kind or another and enforcement actions by the Department of Labor. There's also, in all likelihood, going to be lawsuits filed in order to try to enjoin the rule. And we anticipate that multiple associations will be engaged in that activity, will certainly be involved, Hal's firm will be involved, and we're not going to be alone. Because this needs to be challenged in a very, very direct way, because certainly I believe that one of the greatest duties that I have is to maintain the confidentiality of the communications that I have with clients. And when the Department of Labor tells me to complete a box that says other, and I don't know what other means, but I do know that I have to reveal the nature of the conversation that I had with the client and risk going to jail or being disbarred, I haven't put 40 years into this profession in order to see that to be my legacy. So, we're going to do everything we can in order to make sure that we stop this.
And Hal Coxon, can you explain how the Department of Labor, after 50 years, can effectively change the statute, the LMRDA, by changing the definition of the advice exception or by expanding the scope of beyond union organizing to include all protected concerted activity?
Well, the Labor Department has the authority to interpret the statute. It does not have the authority to change the statute. And, of course, one of our contentions will be this changes the statute because it not only broadens the interpretation of advice, excuse me, but it also includes things that were never intended to be advice and that were intended to be excluded. And so therefore, you know, we feel that the Department of Labor certainly has the right or the authority to interpret a statute, but not to change it. And that's exactly what they're doing here. It's directly contrary to the intent of members of Congress. In fact, Senator Jack Kennedy, when there was a blanket exclusion proposed by then Senator Goldwater for lawyers, Senator Kennedy said, "Well, I don't think that's necessary. This language is perfectly clear. We understand that advice from lawyers is not to be covered." Well, here they are with this revision covering lawyers and requiring lawyers and others to report. And don't forget, employers have to report as well. It's not just the lawyers and the law firms. The employers have to report. They don't have to report for in-house advice that they give, but they have to report if they retain an outside firm. And so they're required to report as well.
And as I read Form LM-20, it literally requires that a copy of any agreement between the law firm and the employer for persuader services has to be submitted to the federal government, the U.S. Department of Labor, in a full copy form for public disclosure. Is that literal interpretation correct, Hal?
Yes, it is. I mean, it is a public document. Unions certainly will use it in corporate campaigns and in organizing campaigns. They will say, for example, look how much your employer is paying these law firms and consultants. If they had put that money into the contract or into the product or into research, think of how much better off you would be. So it definitely will be, it's a public document, and it will be used as such by unions against employers and law firms.
Mike, we have a couple of minutes before we go into the audience Q&A. Do you have any additional comments to add?
Well, I think that this is extremely broad and very, very troubling. I think you have to tie it back into a revision to the National Labor Relations Act in 1947, when Section 8C was inserted into the law that gives the employer the right to talk to their employees about unions. Unions have been in mourning ever since. And what this proposal is really trying to do is to impede the ability of employers to exercise their 8C rights. Today, with the decisions coming out from the labor board, with the expansive definition of protected concerted activity, with the reviews of employee handbooks and the like that are necessary in order to make sure that you're in compliance with an ever-changing number of rules and regulations coming from this labor board, it's absolutely imperative for employers to have third-party assistance in order to make sure that they're in compliance with the law. This is all designed to impede getting that third-party assistance because the lawyer is going to have to say to the company, you're going to have to report this on a form. I'm going to have to report this on a form. Or perhaps I don't have to report this on a form because I don't believe that this really should be reported at all because I think that this is protected, or I still don't think it's persuader. And then the employer is going to say, well, are you sure? So what should I do? Can I get in trouble if I disagree with your opinion? Absolutely, there I have a conflict. So you have to get independent advice in order to determine whether or not you should or should not report, because I don't think this falls within other, but you may get independent advice that it is within other. And at that point in time, the client or the prospective client is going to say, aha, I've now found another reason for never talking to a lawyer, because I have no idea what in the world this individual is talking to me about. And that's exactly what this is designed to do. This is not about transparency, as the proponents of it say that it is. This is not a simple proposal. This is a devious way of effectively amending the National Labor Relations Act and doing it in a way that was never intended under the LMRDA, because lawyers, when they're giving advice to their clients pursuant to the attorney-client relationship, are not performing the middleman services that Jack and Bobby Kennedy found was epidemic in this country and that needed to stop and still needs to be stopped and still needs to be reported. But that's not what lawyers do.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I think we've reached the point where we should see if there are any questions from the audience. Dean, do you want to take the lead on that?
Yes, thanks very much. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that prompt, push the pound button and then the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And before we go to the first audience question, let me make a brief programming announcement about another Teleform call coming up. Wednesday at 1 p.m. is our next scheduled Teleform conference call. We'll be discussing information sharing and privacy in the context of cybersecurity. This is one in a long series of cybersecurity Teleforms we're hosting. That's Wednesday at 1 p.m. at this same number. And as always, we have a number of Teleform conference calls in development, so I urge you to check the Federalist Society's website for a complete and changing list of upcoming Teleform conference calls. Bill, we've got three callers with questions so far. Why don't we go to the first caller?
Hi, gentlemen. Besides exceeding the congressional intent argument, what other reasons would be the grounds for suing to enjoin the final rule?
Well, this is Mike Lotito. I'll state one, and then Hal can give some others. But Hal mentioned the regulatory process where the department says that the impact that this is going to have is $823,000 or something. We believe that that economic analysis is woefully inadequate, just fundamentally incorrect. The department didn't even, for example, have an economic analysis as to what it would take for law firms and other third-party consulting firms to fill out the LM21 form. So another basis of attack is going to be that the department did not do what it's supposed to do under the Administrative Procedure Act in doing a correct economic analysis. There's a piece that was published, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago by a scholar from the Manhattan Institute, Diana Farragut Roth, that's out there in the public domain. If you can't get it, send me a note and I'll send it to you. And she goes to great length in discussing the deficiencies of the economic analysis that the department put forth. So that clearly will be another basis.
Yeah, and in addition to that, I think, and this ought to be near and dear to the hearts of the callers on this call, federalism. I think that the conflict that this sets up for attorneys between the State Bar Association Disciplinary Committee rules on attorney confidences or client confidences and this new interpretation, I think, is a classic federalism argument because the State Bar Association rules are governed by state courts. And, of course, the LMRDA is governed by federal courts. So, I mean, I think that the federalism argument is yet another reason for opposing this and litigating it.
There's also a very strong free speech argument under the federal Constitution, the First Amendment, because while theoretically employers wouldn't be restricted by this statute from speaking to their employees, in reality, employers are not going to be able to speak to their employees because they won't be able to get the expert advice that they need, usually under urgent circumstances, and Hal alluded to those previously. So that free speech argument is definitely available. And also, along the same line, someone mentioned Section 8C of the National Labor Relations Act, which has been construed by the Supreme Court as providing a free speech right for employers, similar to the right under the Constitution. The Section 8C states very emphatically that employers shall have the right to communicate with their employees about unionization, and the Supreme Court has emphatically declared that that includes as a matter of federal policy, a preference for a robust discussion between employers and employees with respect to unionization. And that that robust discussion isn't going to happen if employers and their lawyers are under these restrictions.
Stated somewhat simply, under the interpretation that we've had for half a century, when advice is coupled with persuasion, the exemption applies because lawyers give advice that is designed in part to persuade. And that is the way the statute was intended. Under the department's proposal, persuasion always trumps advice. And it's very difficult for lawyers to give quote-unquote legal advice, an object of which, directly or indirectly, is not intended to persuade. So what this proposed rule does is it takes the statute and it puts it on its head.
Should we take another question from the audience?
Yes.
All right. We've got two questions pending at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, hi. This is Rod Sullivan at Florida Coastal School of Law. If this sounds a little basic, I apologize, but I had never heard of the persuader rules until today.
And you and 350 million other people.
Yeah, and I'm actually, I mean, quite frankly, if you just told me about this, I might have been skeptical. And then I read the statute, and this is it's breathtaking, quite frankly. But I guess my question is more basic: is does this only apply to companies that already have an organized labor force or are in the process of organizing a labor force, or does this apply to every employer?
It applies to every employer. Sorry, Al, I didn't mean to step on your tongue. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So basically, anytime a lawyer advises an employer on creating an employee handbook, you're going to have to file an LM-20?
Yeah. Because, for example, the Labor Board has identified confidentiality rules, rules with respect to how to conduct an investigation. In one case, decided fairly recently in Banner Health, the Labor Board held that a rule in employee handbook that said that conducting a workplace investigation when the employer advises the employees that all conversations should be kept confidential and that they shouldn't discuss with anybody the nature of the investigation, that was overbroad because it infringes upon the employee's ability to engage in Section 7 rights, presumably to go to a union organizer and say, hey, there's an investigation of sex harassment going on. So the conscientious employer goes to its outside law firm and says, well, we want to comply with the law. Could you review my employee handbook? You got any union organizing going on? No. Have you any union organizing going on? No. Do you think you're being subjected to union organizing? No. As a matter of fact, we're in Florida, right to work state. It's the craziest thing from my mind. But the fact is, I want to comply with the law. What the hell do I do? Well, you're a persuader. Cut me a break.
Yeah, this is chilling. I'm just amazed. But thank you.
Well, you know, in addition, most employers have positive employee relations programs. These are programs that they put forward with the intent of keeping employees happy and with the subsidiary intent of, therefore, not encouraging them to engage in collective bargaining or to seek outside union representation. All of that, which may have nothing to do with a current campaign, there may be no petition filed, there may have never been a petition filed, and there may never be a petition filed, but it still would be required as to be reported as persuader activity.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
You're welcome. But just to your point about that you didn't know about it, this is truly stealth labor law reform.
Yeah, well, it's frightening that that the Obama administration can reinterpret an act, the passers of which are all now deceased, to mean basically something that apparently was never intended to mean.
That's correct, and I can tell you that because since I have no life, I actually read the entire McClellan history, which goes on for volume after volume after volume, and there's only about 50 pages of it that deals with a guy by the name of Nathan Schefferman and his consulting firm that did all of this middleman stuff. Almost all of it dealt with corruption and other issues involving unions and employers.
And it involved deception. I mean, here there's no deception. I don't think there's an employee in the country who doesn't understand that his or her employer is being counseled by a law firm. Sure, they understand it. And they understand, if they're interested in unions, that unions are counseled by union law firms. So there's no deception. There's no one who's trying to masquerade as an employee, which is what the original act was designed to address.
Indeed, if an employer today, I don't care what size the company, if an employer today thinks that somehow they can divine what the National Labor Relations Board is going to say tomorrow is the law under the National Labor Relations Act, and they don't need third-party support in order to be able to figure that out and interpret it as it applies to their policies and procedures, I suggest to you that that employer is divorced from reality.
You know, we try to tell people about the administrative state, and they don't quite understand what it means, but this is a good example of how administrative agencies have taken over for Congress.
Well, and we appreciate the Federalist Society giving us this platform so that we can talk about it in order to get people more aware of it.
This is Dean Reuter. Let me ask you a question about the thinking of the Department of Labor. I've read on their website that their take, I assume, is that the current interpretation of advice, the word advice, has resulted in an underreporting of employer and consultant persuader agreements. Is that the extent of the hook they have here for reinterpreting advice? I take it they're not saying they wouldn't agree that they're over-interpreting. They would agree that they're reinterpreting, but they would assert they're reinterpreting within the bounds of the statute. Isn't that correct?
Well, what they're saying is that there's under-reporting, because there's under-reporting if you take their interpretation of advice as the law. And if their interpretation of advice is correct, then people aren't reporting. But that's not the correct interpretation.
And I think that, you know, the department has a pretty high burden, and there's some authority for this proposition, to be able to say for the last 50 years, everybody's been wrong. And we're now right. We're the ones who reread this, and we figured it out. And you can forget all of the other stuff in our old interpretive manual, et cetera. But because there's this quote unquote underreporting, and they cite to a couple of studies that are designed to make employers look bad, even though the underlying validity of those quote unquote studies are subject to extreme attack because there's no real scholarly research behind it in the biased way that those studies were conducted. The department, it seems to me, has a very, very, very heavy burden.
But the union's
best argument in this administrative law, doesn't that undermine the Department of Labor's interpretation, because they're changing the established interpretation after such a long period of time?
There is authority for that proposition, but you know, it certainly doesn't stop the department from trying. And it certainly doesn't make life any easier on the intended targets of this proposed rule in order to be able to prepare for its ultimate finalization, which is what I said earlier, Bill, and I know Hal agrees. We hope that as a result of some of the outreach and some of the publicity and articles such as the Manhattan Scholar, and some other things that are out there, that people are going to start saying this is crazy, and the department is going to say, well, we think it's crazy too. And I think that there's an opportunity for, assuming he's confirmed, Labor Secretary Perez, if he ever gets to that point, to take a look at this and to say this isn't where we should be spending our time and effort. This is just wrong.
The union's best argument, frankly, is what difference does it make whether a lawyer talks directly to employees in an effort to persuade the employees not to engage in collective bargaining, or if the lawyer drafts something for the employer to read to the employees. It's still communications with employees. And I think there's a world of difference between that, and that is the law does not require advice given to employers to be considered persuader activity and to be reported. And if the unions don't like that, the proper approach is rather than reinterpreting or revising a long-standing accepted and bright line test that everyone understands to require reporting of advice and client confidences. If they want to do that, they should go to Congress and try to amend the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. But instead, they're going backdoor through the regulatory process, and they're also going backdoor on the Employee Free Choice Act and other labor law reforms to accomplish exactly the same thing, and that is forced recognition and bargaining without an election. If there are unfair labor practices committed, which undoubtedly there will be, especially by many smaller employers that don't have the advantage of outside counsel or in-house counsel, and the NLRB issues a bargaining order, which it undoubtedly will with this current NLRB.
Well, Bill, we've got at least one more question pending. Should we go to the next caller?
Yes, please.
And a reminder to our audience, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to join the conversation. Our lines will be open after this next question.
Hi, this is Jim Markowski in New York. I do provide labor advice to some of my clients, which are small businesses. Three simple examples. Would this be covered under the proposed rule? Advising a client and setting up a parallel double-breasting company, and these are all union shops, advising a company on withdrawal liability and options with respect to withdrawal liability in a multi-employer plan situation, and advising on whether certain provisions of a collective bargaining agreement under a pattern bargaining arrangement would violate the antitrust laws.
Well, curious, this is Mike. Let's see what Hal says. I think the first two are clearly yes, because an object of that advice, setting up the double breast operation so that it's union free, an object of that advice, directly or indirectly, is to influence individuals. I also think that your second example would also have at least an indirect impact on the Section 7. I'm not so sure about the third situation under the CBA with the antitrust. Hal, what do you think about that?
I'm not so sure about that one either, but I agree entirely with you that the first two are definitely covered and would no longer be considered advice, exempt from reporting.
Well, that's very scary.
Well, we agree.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, we agree.
Right.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. We have one more question pending. Bill, should we take this final question?
Yes, please.
All right. This will be our final question.
Hi, this is Mitch Berman from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My question is this going to basically hurt small and medium-sized businesses more because they can't afford the in-house counsel, where the larger corporations are going to be able to just bring that in-house to avoid the regulation?
Well, you know, there are many misconceptions about this. One is that it's only a law firm problem. It's only a boutique labor specialty firm problem. It's not a problem for big corporate law firms. And there's a misconception that this is only a small business problem. It doesn't affect large companies because they have in-house counsel. They have labor relations expertise. I would say that both are misconceptions. First of all, if you're a large law firm, you may not even have a labor department or section, but you certainly do things that touch upon issues that affect employees' choice. And we've talked about some of them, dealing with pensions, dealing with other aspects to the practice by big corporate law firms. So big corporate law firms are going to be covered by this, and they're going to have to report, and they're going to have to report all labor relations services for all of their clients, and I don't think any of them want to do that. Secondly, as far as small business versus large companies, while it's true they have in-house counsel, they still retain outside counsel. They retain crisis communications firms and public relations firms when there's a corporate campaign where they need advice on how to deal with shareholder actions and how to deal with boycotts and how to deal with those types of things that that affect the corporate brand. They're going to hire outside consultants, whether they're law firms or not, and those consultants are going to have to report. And so therefore, consultants, and we've had at least one big PR firm say, well, they're going to get out of that business if that's the case, because they don't want to report all of their clients and all of the activities that they do for various clients because of the persuader rule. So it's going to narrow the choice and perhaps even eliminate the advice that even large companies need and expect.
Just to expand upon that just for a second, go back to the Affordable Care Act. Clearly, employers are struggling with respect to the implementation. Even a large employer, let alone a small or medium-sized employer, they're going to need law firm advice. They may need a benefit consulting firm advice. They need law firm advice. They go to those individual shops, and they're saying, we need a holistic strategy here. If we lower the number of hours to below 30, what's that going to do to our brand? What's that going to do to the employer of choice? What's this possibility? What's that possibility? How are we going to message this? What are our rights? What are our obligations? What are our fines? And by the way, if we do this, if we mess this up, that whole employer of choice concept, if our employees think that somehow we're trying to take advantage of them, this is going to be a real problem with respect to morale. It's really going to impact that. And who knows? Some of the employees are liable to say, let's go join a union. So we need the best advice that we can get from all of you in order to come up with a holistic strategy in order to figure out how to deal with this law that only has 20,000 pages of regulations to it. Well, they're all persuaders. That's all reportable, and nobody gets it.
And they're reportable, Mike, under the other category that you mentioned.
Yeah, the good old other. All else fails, we've always got other.
And if that large law firm provides anything that amounts to persuader advice to one client for, let's say, for 1 hour, that opens that firm up to reporting all of the legal fees that it receives from all of its law firm clients for labor and employment law services, very, very broadly construed for the entire fiscal year.
I think
the identity of the clients and the amount of the fees paid.
I think it's pretty gutsy for the Department of Labor to issue a proposed form that has a category of other, which, if you don't guess right as to what other means under this expansive interpretation, you risk either being disbarred or going to jail.
And that's why the American Bar Association felt so strongly about this and wrote a letter urging its withdrawal. They fought this battle back in 1959, now here it is back again in its worst form.
Demonstrating the famous statement in Washington, D.C., no bad idea ever goes away.
We have a minute or two, I think. Any closing comments, Hal?
No, well, I would close by urging everyone on this call to help us. You're probably saying, okay, now we understand the problem. What can we do? I think there are a lot of things you can and should do. One is contact your state bar association, your local bar association, your city bar association, bringing this to their attention. Number two, communicating with Congress on this issue, making sure they understand that this is not just transparency. This is not good government. This, in fact, is the opposite of that. Also communicate either through letters to the editor or discussions with editorial board writers or in the media so that the public understands this. This is one of the best-kept secrets, and as long as it's secret, it has a chance of being enacted. And so I think we need to make sure the media understands this. And finally, I would urge you who are members of trade associations to get your trade associations involved, get your fellow employers involved, and speak out against these proposed regulations.
Okay, Hal Coxon and Mike Letito, thank you very much for very informative remarks. And Dean, I think it's time, and I'll turn this back over to you.
Well, thank you all. I'm going to thank Mr. Bill Manuel, Hal Coxon, and Michael Letito for joining us today. Certainly a very interesting call. To the audience, I want to invite you again to join us for our next scheduled conference call, telephone conference call, Wednesday at 1 p.m. on cybersecurity. And always, as always, be alert to changes in that schedule. We might have an additional call tomorrow or Thursday or Friday. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.